Charlotte, the SmackDown champion, has a terrible moonsault. And if you ever saw it, you would even say it blows. All of the other wrestlers point and laugh and call her names. They beg and plead with Charlotte to stop because the move is lame. Then one foggy Christmas Eve, Charlotte buried Tony, climbed up top and jumped right off. Missed again, all hope is lost. The move never hits, it's awful. I'll even give her $10 if she agrees to stop it, 'cause Charlotte's moonsault fucking sucks. Seriously, it sucks. Stop doing it.
It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered!
You like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh my God, we're only an hour in. We have 2 more hours of this.
SmackDown sucks. It's almost as bad as Raw.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and threaten me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Solo Monster? Who are you to doubt El Dandy?
It's the Sound Off Christmas show. I didn't think that it was possible for Charlotte Flair to find a move worse than her usual moonsault. But she has managed to do it. Maybe Santa got her a new move for Christmas. But I hope all of you who are celebrating this weekend had a very Merry Christmas. Today marks the anniversary of John Huber's death. 1 year to the day that Luke Harper and WWE Brody Lee in AEW passed away from a rare lung issue that was diagnosed as idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. And he was only 41 years old. AEW put on the greatest Dynamite episode last year in its history with their tribute show to Brody Lee. They have treated his family like gold. His wife now works for AEW's community relations department. Their son, their older son, still makes the occasional TV appearance as a member of the Dark Order. It's the worst thing a child could go through, is losing a parent, and to lose one so young like that and so suddenly without even being able to say goodbye is a horrible thing. The whole story is horrible. I mean, here one day and healthy, gone the next, out of nowhere, just like that. I mean, that's a big, strong man. 275 pounds when he stepped into the ring with Cody Rhodes in that dog collar match, which turned out to be his final match. 2 months later, laying in that hospital bed, he was down to 170 pounds. I can't even imagine him in my mind being that small. So it's tragic. It's absolutely tragic. It's a shame he never got to debut in his hometown because the world shut down that week. It's a shame he never got to perform in front of actual live crowds for AEW. It's a shame that he won't see his son grow up to follow in his shoes. I'm sure that is the path that he is on. You know, the kid's already been bitten by the bug. His future is already mapped out. And as is the case whenever somebody passes away, it's a shame that he couldn't see all of the love that he got until it was too late for him to see it. Because by all accounts, he was a good dude. He was a funny person to hang around with. And so today, we remember Mr. Brody Lee. And if you have any papers laying around, roll them up and whack somebody over the head with them. This is episode 736 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, December 26th, 2021, the final sound off of the year, our biggest and most successful year to date for the show, both here and on YouTube, and I thank you for that. My father would have turned 64 years old today. It's been almost 7 years already. It's hard to believe. I've got thoughts on Cody Christ winning the TNT title on Christmas Day. The reaction to his win on social media has been treated with the level of rationality that one would have expected. So I'll be the one to give you the smart take, like I do every week. I've got day one predictions for the first WWE pay-per-view of the new year coming up this Saturday. Where I think things are headed for Bobby Lashley at WrestleMania and for MVP going forward. Their partnership may be coming to an end. And it finally happened. After 2 years and a lot of prodding by you guys, I have finally sat down and watched Joker the other night, and I've got some thoughts to share about that as well. So a lot of stuff to get into. You can now give The Sound Off a 5-star rating on Spotify. Like Apple Podcasts, they have finally added a star rating system. Meltzer would be proud. So if you would be so kind, even if you don't usually listen in Spotify, go to our show page on Spotify in the app and give the show a 5-star rating. And I do thank you. If you want to make a PayPal donation and support The Sound Off, you may do so on thesolemonster.com. As many of you did this week, $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout out. Santa Solomonster's Naughty or Nice list. These are the folks that have been nice this week. And I gotta shout them out and say thanks to the Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, who went above and beyond this week with the support. And I also want to wish a very happy birthday to his beautiful girlfriend, Victoria. I'm sure Paul, listening to me while you guys were on your Hawaiian getaway, just made you super happy. But really, I hope you had a terrific birthday, and I wish both of you a fantastic new year. Max the Axe Velado says, to the hardest working man in the IWC, happy holidays. So thank you, Max. First time I ever heard from Max, he dropped the PayPal 5 years ago. So I must be doing something right to get that kind of love. Nitrous Oxide, Nathan Cadia, thank you for the kind words. Night Stalker, Naif Al-Safar, Big Bear, Brian Becerra, Beast Mode, Brock Joseph, Killshot, Keith Hart, Dream Chaser, Chauncey Curry, The Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, The Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, and the entire Soep family, wishing all of you a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Brett Brickfist Brode, happy 37th birthday, brother. The Gentleman Masher, Shane Maniacci, who is wishing everybody a happy holiday. Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, New York Punk, Arnold Modesto, John Raging Mad Riffle, Ostentatious Alan Carter, Caleb Showtime Lindley, Mean Matt Forbush, Sherrod Big Daddy Boyd, the Pastor of Pain, Damian Yule, Malevolent Michael Timoney, Grave Digger Brandon DeBlanc, and Sweet Sapphire Sarah Kittleson. Thank you all for your support, not only this week and around the holidays, but all year long. Hear a lot of these same names over and over again every year. You guys keep sticking with me and coming back, and I hope you do the same in 2022. Next week is the first Sound Off of 2022, so any PayPals that come in this week, you will be shouted out on our day one of the new year. I mean, technically it'll be day two, but it's our day one. I got a few things I just want to mention here before we get into the news of the week. For those of you who may have missed it, if you are a Sound Off channel member, and if you are not, please consider becoming one, because a brand new hour-long video Q&A went up this week answering your questions. If you are a channel member, you know how this works. I usually put a post up, I ask for one question from each of you, and I get a whole bunch, and I answered almost 50 of them this week, and that is up exclusively for our channel members on YouTube. I am also planning on going live at some point this week with the pilot episode of our new call-in show, Better Call Saul. Better Call Saul, a monster. We're going to do a pilot episode. Take your phone calls. We'll interact. If you have comments, questions, I will let you guys know what day that's going to be. I'm still debating which day we want to do this, but it'll be at some point this week. So if you are a channel member, keep an eye out for that. I've gotten questions about whether or not I'm doing a top 10 matches of the year, which I do every year. I'm actually doing a top 15. And the answer is yes. And I will also keep you guys posted on social media when that'll be going up. I might go live for that on video, we'll see. But yes, there will be a top 15 matches of 2021, my personal list of what I believe were the top 15 matches that I saw all year. and why. So we'll be doing that. New Year's Eve is coming up on Friday night. If you remember last year, I was live on YouTube for the first time on New Year's Eve. And we had a blast. And we rang in the new year together, just hanging out, answering your questions. This year, New Year's Eve is on a Friday, which means Rampage. There was no Rampage last year. Rampage only debuted in August. So there will be a brand new episode of AEW Rampage on Friday. I will either be going live as soon as it ends, or possibly even during the show. I might not want to wait until 11 o'clock. But yes, I will be live on New Year's Eve. So if you have no New Year's Eve plans, or even if you do, if you're going to be hanging out at home, put the show on in the background, and hang out with the Solo Monster as we head into the new year. So that's coming up on Friday. And finally, next Saturday, day one, first WWE pay-per-view of the new year. I'm going to be doing predictions for that a little bit later after the Raw and SmackDown review. I will be live on YouTube the night after New Year's Eve. So as soon as day one ends, we'll recap all the goings-on on YouTube like we do for every pay-per-view. So busy, busy week coming up. No rest for the weary. And I hope you will join me and be part of all of it. Unfortunately, we got some sad news to get into here. Former WWE star Corporal Kirshner died this week of a heart attack at the age of 64. It was said that his wife tried to save him, but it was too late. That was a blast from the past hearing his name again. I used to have the Corporal Kirshner LJN figure. I still have a whole bunch of my LJNs, but I don't think I have Corporal Kirshner anymore. I think I left him on the battlefield somewhere. But I used to have his LJN. And I remember his match with Nikolai Volkov at WrestleMania 2. Beyond that, I don't remember much else about his run. And he wasn't there for very long. But his background is kind of interesting. He was a paratrooper in the 82nd Airborne, jumping out of airplanes when he was a teenager. He never actually saw combat. He met Hulk Hogan in the gym one day when Hogan was still in the AWA, and that's how he got his foot in the door. Ended up training with Vern Gagne. Vern didn't really think he was anything special, and so he never used him, although he did train him. Where he got his break was after Sergeant Slaughter had his falling out with Vince McMahon over the whole G.I. Joe deal, which was a whole mess. You know, Hasbro wanted a real-life spokesperson for G.I. Joe. Slaughter got the job, and he was all excited, and he went and he told Vince McMahon about it. And Vince said, no, you're not doing it. I just signed a deal with LJN for a toy line. LJN at the time was a direct competitor to Hasbro. And so things got really heated. Slaughter gave his notice, and he said Vince wouldn't accept it. He was still trying to convince him to stay. Oh, you know, my father is sick, and we're heading into the first WrestleMania. You can't leave me now. So then lawyers got involved, and Vince claimed you can't be Sergeant Slaughter if you leave because I own Sergeant Slaughter. And Slaughter's attorney said otherwise. You don't own shit. So anyway, Slaughter was gone, and Corporal Kirshner ended up filling the role of the patriotic hero for all the boys and girls. Outside of that one WrestleMania win in 86, he didn't do anything in the company, and he was gone by 87. But he ended up having a career resurgence under a totally different character. He's one of the few, you know, he played that Corporal Kirshner role. He was never a major, major star, but, you know, he did gain national notoriety working for Vince. But then he had this whole second career for himself, playing a totally different character, ripped off from the Texas Chainsaw Massacre movie. He played Leatherface, and Super Leather, as he was called in some places. He would come to the ring in the rubber mask, like Leatherface in the movie. It was like made out of human, not really made out of human skin, but that was the mask that he would wear to the ring. He was wielding a chainsaw, and he went and worked for different hardcore deathmatch promotions in Japan, like FMW and Wing. I mean, you look at photos of him in the getup, you know who he looks like? He reminds me a lot of Mankind. There's something about the mask and the shirt with the tie, he looks just like Mankind. But then something very bizarre happened in 2006, and I remember reading about this at the time, and it was very bizarre even then. In 2006, WWE.com reported that he had died. but they listed his real name as Thomas Spear, which is definitely not his real name. His mother had to call WWE to tell him that her son was very much still alive because she was getting calls from friends and family asking, oh, is he okay? The next day, they pulled the story, but they never bothered issuing any kind of correction. They never issued a retraction. I mean, he even did one of those Where Are They Now features on WWE.com. I think it was like 5 years later. Never once did they bring any of this up. Yeah, you just know that there's some people who read that post on WWE.com all those years ago who heard about his death this week. They heard that Corporal Kirshner died, and their first thought was, again? Because WWE never bothered issuing any kind of retraction. Sadly, this time he really is dead. So rest in peace to the good Corporal. AEW Dynamite on Wednesday was an excellent show. They were also back over 1 million overnight viewers for the first time since October. So if you're Tony Khan, that's what you want to see with Dynamite moving to TBS in 10 days. Kyle O'Reilly. Let's talk about Kyle O'Reilly here for a second because probably the worst kept secret, especially after Adam Cole was on TV the week before teasing a surprise, a holiday surprise this week for the Young Bucks. And it seemed pretty likely that it was going to be the debut of Kyle O'Reilly, and in fact, that's what it was. Kyle O'Reilly showed up on Dynamite this week. He provided the assist to Adam Cole in his match against Orange Cassidy, so Cole picked up the win. We had the Young Bucks coming down to the ring and sort of confronting Cole, and Fish and O'Reilly were standing with Cole, and they were teasing possible tension between the two sides. Cole and Fish and O'Reilly all left together. The Bucks looked like they were betrayed almost, like, you know, you didn't tell us he was coming in here. What does this all mean? Kyle tweeted after the show, he said, life is crazy and I'm very grateful that my pro wrestling abilities have taken me to a new frontier in which to explore my ass-kicking ways. Proud to be a part of AEW and thanks to Tony Khan for the opportunity. If you are a fan of mine from elsewhere, I hope you continue to support me. If you are new to Kyle O'Reilly, prepare to see a man that pours his effing soul into that ring every night and has an unquenchable thirst for cans of whoop-ass. Also, Red Dragon is back. Red Dragon being back together is the best part about Kyle O'Reilly coming into AEW. Kyle O'Reilly by himself is not a game changer. Kyle O'Reilly, people coming at me this week, oh, what a, yeah, Kyle O'Reilly, that's going to really change the game for AEW. Because these are the people that are very upset that he left WWE to go to AEW. Now, had he stayed with NXT, had he stayed with WWE, these are the first people that would have jumped to his defense and said, see, he made a wise move. He knew where his bread is buttered, and now he can do this, or he can, you know, go to SmackDown. He could, but of course, he didn't. And so he is now public enemy number one to a lot of these people. But nobody was saying that Kyle O'Reilly on his own was going to be any kind of a game changer. Where Kyle O'Reilly fits in best is part of this budding storyline, it would seem, with the Elite, which I'll get to in a second. But it's as a tag team with Bobby Fish. They've worked together for so many years. They had great matches together in Ring of Honor and other places when they came into NXT. Kyle is a very good professional wrestler, but Red Dragon together against the Bucks, Red Dragon against FTR, Red Dragon against the Lucha Bros, Red Dragon against the Jurassic Express, Proud and Powerful, Top Flight, once Darius Martin comes back. I have a feeling the Briscoes are coming in soon. There is no shortage of great tag teams for them to work with. And for Bobby Fish, it could not come at a better time, because all Bobby Fish has really been good for since coming into AEW is laying on his back and looking up at the lights. And that's likely to happen a little bit less in a tag team with Kyle O'Reilly. So for both guys, it just made sense. We've talked about this before. There was no future for Kyle O'Reilly in WWE, and he knew that. This has got to be the easiest decision this guy's ever made. This was a no-brainer. What do you think, he's going to go to AEW and make peanuts? I'm sure he's still making a good living for himself. But for his career, this is the move that he had to make. And now what this sets up, based on that little tease that we saw on Wednesday, is a future program or match between the Undisputed Era, and yes, they're not going to go by that name, but I'm calling them that for now until they come up with a name of their own, Undisputed Era against the Elite once Kenny Omega is ready to come back. And there is no timetable for Omega's return. It's not happening for at least another couple of months, maybe longer. Remember, he was going to have surgeries on every part of his body, it sounded like. So he's not going to be back so quickly. So they can take their time with this, but ultimately that's the destination. It has to be. I mean, they teased it the night after Omega lost the chance, or not the night after, but that first Dynamite after Full Gear when Omega was in that backstage promo and said that he's going to be leaving for a while. And remember, Adam Cole butted in and said, "Don't worry, Cleaner, I got you." And he wasn't talking to Cole, he was talking to the Bucks. Even that little tease that they planted there, you knew that at some point things were going to break down between Omega and Cole, possibly for who leads the Elite. Well, now Cole's got his buddies in here, and it's just tailor-made for 3-on-3. So that's where they're headed with that, I believe. The other big announcement on the show was that we are getting the rematch between Bryan Danielson and Hangman Page for the AEW World title. We have a date. Hangman and Danielson Part 2 is now set for the very first TBS Dynamite, which is coming up on Wednesday, January 5th. Danielson said he doesn't want Hangman to stall things out, like he claims that he did in their first match. No draws this time. And if there is, we're going to have judges. Now, they haven't announced who the judges are going to be. I assume it's not going to be a bunch of celebrities like the NWA did with Sting and Flair back in 88 at the first Clash. There will be no Jason Hervey at ringside. Probably bring in some wrestling legends. Who knows? They may bring in Bret Hart to be a judge for this Bryan Danielson match. Whoever they bring in, it won't go to the judges. The judges are just there to wave and say hello. This is not going to a time limit draw again. But that is the stipulation that they have come up with, and so that is now set. We knew it was going to happen either on that Wednesday or that Saturday, because the Battle of the Belt show is that weekend on TNT. That's only a one-hour show, so they're not going to have enough time to put every title on the line on that show. We only know one match so far for Battle of the Belts. That's Britt Baker defending against Riho, and she's not losing her title either. Neither is Hangman. I think this is where he gets the definitive win over Danielson on January 5th. But I thought the segment with them was very well done. You know, the little back and forth that they had. The first match was great. I'm sure the second match will be no different. The main event on Wednesday was a lot of fun. It was CM Punk partnering with Sting, doing anything really with Sting for the very first time in his career, and Darby Allin, together against MJF and FTR, or I guess as they call themselves, MJFTR. And, you know, Sting comes out there with the CM Punk-inspired face paints. He's got the lightning bolts painted under his eyes and the tape fists on his forehead. And he looked really cool with the new paint. CM Punk comes out there cosplaying like Sting. He had the old kind of the long black Sting tights with the Scorpion logo on the side, the red boots. He had the old Surfer Sting face paint. And he looked like he was having a blast. Of course, there was that one horrifying moment during the match where Sting went to hip toss MJF out over the top rope, and FTR was to catch him. MJF got a little too much hang time when he jumped out over the top rope, and he kind of overshot FTR. He landed, and I took a screenshot of there. I found one. But I took it, and I tweeted it to somebody who was like, what's the context? Because I posted something, and I guess they didn't see the match. As soon as I posted the image, you know, their reaction was the same as mine. Holy shit. This guy came straight down on top of his head. But it was also on a part of the floor where the mats ended and you had concrete. That little area between where the mat ends and the metal or the steel barricade. And he came head first down. Cash Wheeler saw it and he immediately crawled over to check and make sure he was okay. Somehow he's okay. MJF is fine, but that was a very scary moment, but a fun main event. And they had an excellent video package dedicated to Owen Hart. They actually used footage from New Japan Pro Wrestling, thanks to Rocky Romero. With his help, he was able to facilitate that. And so we had footage of him back, you know, when he was, I guess that would have been probably 89? I mean, it was before his first run in WWE. He may have gone back after, because he had left WWE and then eventually came back. So the footage looked great, you know, as far as quality-wise. And so they put that together. They had testimonials from people like Adam Cole and Matt Hardy and Mark Henry and Eddie Kingston, Dustin Rhodes, talking about Owen. And the only thing we know is that there will be two tournaments, one for the men, one for the women, that will be starting next year. They will culminate at Double or Nothing in May. And Owen's widow, Martha, will be there to present the cups, the trophies, to each of the winners. We still don't know anything about the format. Single elimination is probably what it's going to end up being. Could be round robin, but it doesn't look that way at this point. That's all we know. But I thought the video they put together was very well done. Now, last night was a rare Saturday night episode of Rampage, taped on Wednesday in Greensboro. One of the best episodes that they've done of Rampage, with a rare title change on this tape show. And I didn't go live, I just figured I would save it for the show here. So I'll run through this real quick and then talk about the main event. Jungle Boy got a win over Isaiah Cassidy of Private Party. Cassidy is not a singles wrestler. He is not used to being in singles matches. I thought, though, he looked good here. Jungle Boy had his ribs and his quad wrapped up like a mummy. Never really came into play in the match, and he won with the snare trap. Hook picked up a win over Bear Bronson. I like this better than his match with Fuego. You know, Bronson had the size advantage, and Hook was out there throwing this guy around like he was a cruiserweight with those suplexes. Hook just needs to work on those punches. But otherwise, this kid's got something. He's got a presence about him. It's a lot of fun to watch. I could have gone without him no-selling a Rikishi driver like he was Sting out there, but the crowd ate it up. But this was another good match for Hook, only his second. Chris Statlander had a good match with Layla Hirsch, who tapped out to the Spider Crab. She smacked Statlander's hand away after the match when Statlander went in for the handshake. I don't know why we don't see more of Layla on TV. I'd like to see her featured more in the new year. And Cody Rhodes won the TNT Championship back for a third time with a win over Sammy Guevara. Cody wrestled Sammy in the very first match on the very first episode of Dynamite 2 years ago. So I went back in my notes, and this is what I wrote, or part of what I wrote about the start of the match. Cody was massively over in the building. He's a star to this audience. He could do no wrong. What a difference 2 years can make. Cody was not as well-liked here in Greensboro. I love that they invited David Crockett to be there as a guest and to present the title to the winner after the match. I thought that was a nice touch. Sammy hit this insane double jump 450 to the floor onto Cody. And then he went for a jumping Hurricane Rana off the ring steps. Cody caught him, though, and then dumped him, powerbombed him into the front row onto a bunch of clearly planted fans, one of whom had this delayed sell that was comically bad. It's like his brain registered the pain on a 5-second delay. Cody hit the crossroads, Sammy kicked out. Guevara hit the GTH, but Cody kicked out. And Guevara went up for the 630, Cody got his knees up, hit two crossroads, and then looked like he was going for a pedigree, but hit the Tiger Driver 98 instead and got the pin. The match was excellent. I enjoyed the match. The finish is going to be very divisive. And maybe that's the point. Maybe that was by design. I know a lot of people are saying that this is what happens when you book yourself into a corner with Cody not being allowed to challenge for the world title. He has to go after the TNT title instead. Three times now, this man has been the TNT champion, a title that is not even 2 years old. Cody is now a three-time champion. But I don't understand that argument, the people who say that. Well, they booked themselves into a corner, and so that, you know, now he's got to go after the TNT title. I don't understand that argument. If Cody was challenging for the world title and winning it and taking it away from someone like Hangman Page, he would be getting twice as much hate. He would be getting raked over the coals. You think this is bad? All the Cody hate online and the way he's being booed, it would be two or three times as bad as it is now. I would rather he not be chasing after the AEW world title. Leave that for people like Hangman and Omega and Danielson and Punk and MJF. Now, I hate that Sammy's run is over. I thought he was having great matches on TV as the champion. He had the great match with Miro, Jay Lethal, others. I mean, I don't think his run lasted as long as it should have. I think they ended it prematurely. If this is leading to a more defined heel turn for Cody, then great. But the way he won last night, there was nothing that screamed heel about it. The fans were booing him, but he wrestled like a babyface, like he always does. He wrestled no differently than he always does. He even kicked out of Guevara's finish. And Sammy kicked out of his, but he kicked out of Guevara's finish. He didn't cheat. He didn't hold the ropes, rake the eyes. Arn Anderson didn't give him the assist. Nothing like that. Cody is still very much a babyface here. Not unlike, you know, when the fans were booing John Cena or Roman Reigns every week. They didn't wrestle any differently. They just had a building full of people who booed them and hated their guts and were sick of them. But they didn't change the style of match that they had. They wrestled like babyfaces because that's what they were booked to be. Now remember, Dan Lambert said that Scorpio Sky, a heel, is next in line for a shot at the TNT title. They're going to bring the belt to American Top Team. That's what he said. That doesn't sound like a recipe for a Cody Rhodes heel turn either. But if the goal is to feed him wins for a few months and really let this play out and he grows more and more full of himself on TV, they could pay this off by getting somebody else over huge, because by that point, whoever is the one to beat Cody would be a hero to all the people who were booing him every week. And with that thought in mind, after the taping on Wednesday, there was a confrontation. When the cameras went off, there was a confrontation between Cody and Hook. Hook shook Cody's hand and then he slapped him. And Tony Khan promised Greensboro, the next time AEW is back here, we're going to do Cody against Hook, one-on-one. So I propose this. What if the idea is to build to a Greensboro return in the spring? And it, you know what? It doesn't even have to be in Greensboro. You could still give Greensboro that match when you come back eventually. It doesn't even have to be there. It could be Vegas for Double or Nothing. But what if the idea is to build to a match with Hook being the one to beat Cody for the TNT title? Now, I know that sounds premature. This kid has had literally two matches on TV. But Bill Goldberg had his first television match on Nitro in September of 1997. And by April of 98, he was the United States champion and on his way to bigger and better things. And I only use that comparison. I'm not comparing Hook to Bill Goldberg. He's going to be the next Goldberg. I'm not saying that. I use that comparison to illustrate that the people will dictate what and who they want to see, who is over and who is not over, which is one of the things I fucking hated about the Thunderdome era, which is that it was no longer up to you and I as far as who's over and who's not based on audience reaction. It was up to two idiots in the back who decided everything. We're putting all our faith and trust in two old guys in the back to tell us who's over and who's not. That was the worst thing about the Thunderdome era. But that's something that the people will dictate. And as good as Hook has looked in his first two matches, in 6 months, he'll be even better. And if he's still over to this audience at the level that he has been, top-selling t-shirt on pro wrestling tees and all that, and if he's still winning matches, and again, you know, you might think, well, this Hook stuff is going to just die down. You know what? I thought the same thing about Orange Cassidy. But whether you like the guy or not, Orange Cassidy is still one of the more over baby faces in the entire company. Which is why he's featured as much as he is on TV. It wasn't just a fad. Oh, you know, people like Orange Cassidy. The guy has this weird shtick. Give it a few months and the people will be over it. People were saying that 2 years ago. And he's still a big star for them today. So who's to say that in 6 months, the hook fever that you see online isn't even bigger than it is today? So if that's still going on, and this kid's still going out there and winning matches, hasn't lost yet, Cody against Hook for the TNT title could be a real thing that happens. He could be a hero to all these people, taking the championship off of Cody Rhodes. Don't forget how Hook debuted on television. It was a little over a year ago in a segment where his father choked out Cody with the Taz Mission. After Cody made a crack about how Taz's son, he's not training to become a wrestler with you, he's training to become a wrestler with me. He was training with Cody. I don't know if that's legit or if that was just for storyline purposes. He may have been training with Cody at the Nightmare Factory. But he was training with Cody. There's a history there. Now, the tables have turned. Cody is the hated one, and Hook has become this phenomenon that's just taken on a life of its own. You know, people were just having fun with it. And then he stepped into the ring for his first match, and something bizarre happened. He was really good. And he was really good again this week. 5 or 6 more months of being really good, and 6 more months of an increasingly delusional Cody Rhodes could have the makings of a special moment and launching a new star. It's just an idea. But I am taking a wait-and-see approach on this Cody win to see exactly how this plays out. I am very much in the middle on this. I don't completely hate it, but I don't also sit here and lavish love upon it either, because it depends where they go from here. Does Cody need the TNT title? He doesn't. And I hate that Sammy's run is over. But I have to take a wait-and-see approach because there is a way where this could pay off in a big way in a few months, and you can launch a new star. This Wednesday is the final Dynamite of the year, and the final episode on TNT before the move to TBS. They're back at Daly's Place in Jacksonville with Jim Ross back on commentary. He has his final radiation treatment that morning. Eddie Kingston, Santana, and Ortiz take on Daniel Garcia and 2.0. Thunder Rosa takes on Jade Cargill in the TBS title tournament. And Orange Cassidy, who I just mentioned, teams up with Best Friends to take on Adam Cole, Bobby Fish, and Kyle O'Reilly, having his first match in an AEW ring. According to PW Insider, a number of WWE main roster and NXT talents have tested positive for COVID with this Omicron surge. You know, the NFL, the NHL, the NBA, they've all been ravaged by COVID positives. The Minnesota Timberwolves had its entire starting lineup out with COVID. The Jets, they've got 18 players on the COVID list, plus their head coach. WWE is not immune. We don't know any of the names right now, but it could have an effect on the pay-per-view this Sunday. So pay attention to any names that may be missing from TV tomorrow night. That could be a telltale sign. They better have Roman Reigns and Brock Lesnar walking around in hazmat suits to make sure they don't lose their main event. Now, I know there's talk of possibly moving back into the Thunderdome. I don't think there's anything to it firmly. I think it's something Meltzer speculated about in The Observer, which, you know, it's speculation that makes sense with everything going on. Could they potentially have to move back into the Thunderdome? Anything is possible. I don't think that's going to be necessary. But you know what? Even if they do, it don't matter. It doesn't matter. The shows would not be any different. They pipe in so much fake crowd noise every week into these shows. SmackDown on Friday was just ridiculous. You know, being back in the Thunderdome would not feel much different. Raw last Monday stayed focused on promoting the pay-per-view this weekend. There were no candy cane matches. There was no Santa Claus being run over by Alberto Del Dipshit or anything like that. When I said last week that WWE blew through 3 weeks worth of main events in one night by having Bobby Lashley run the gauntlet, also that we could get to the obligatory tag team match, right? I said, the only reason they did this is so we could get the obligatory can they coexist tag team match on TV. It's not a case of I should be picking lottery numbers for everybody. It's that WWE's booking is that predictable. And guess what we got this week on TV? We got a main event of Big E and Bobby Lashley against Seth Rollins and Kevin Owens. And it looks like they're slowly pushing Lashley into the babyface column with how they've booked him on TV these past few weeks. Going back to that video package they aired, there was a Raw show several weeks ago. I don't recall if he was physically on the show, but they had this like 3 or 4 minute long video package showing his early days and his career. And I remember just watching that and it screamed babyface. And since then, you know, he beat all three of his opponents at day one in singles matches all in one night. And then this week, there were a few hints of dissension between him and MVP. Right down to him tagging with Big E in the main event, he was getting cheered for some of his power spots. He pins Kevin Owens for the win, and then Lashley is left laying by the two heels with Rollins, giving him a curb stomp on the ring steps. So Lashley seems to be migrating over to that babyface column. Lashley is not the only one who looks to be going babyface. We finally got the split between AJ Styles and Omos. Even though they've been teasing it for weeks, it still felt rushed to me, especially with them announcing the match between them for tomorrow night. They're not even waiting for the pay-per-view. They're doing it on Raw. They did a Miz TV segment with AJ and Omos. AJ admitted, you know, we've got some issues recently, but now we're back on the same page. And we want to take all the titles in WWE. And Miz was stirring things up, and he said, well, that's not what I heard from Omos. And he said Omos told him he was tired of carrying AJ. And before Omos could respond, out came Rey and Dominic Mysterio for their match. Still no Street Profits match because they were missing from the show for the second straight week. So I don't know if it's an injury. I don't know if it's COVID and there's a quarantine thing going on here. But their match with Rey and Dominic is not advertised for tomorrow either. So something's going on with at least one of them. So instead they wrestled AJ and Omos. Did Rey and Dominic, and they beat them. Rey and Dominic beat them in a 2-minute match. Styles wanted to tag Omos in, and Omos gave him the cold shoulder. And then Rey rolled up AJ for the win. After the match, Styles called him a piece of trash, which is probably not the smartest thing to say to a 7'3" man. Omos shoved him. AJ attacked back. He tried for a phenomenal forearm. Omos blocked it, got him up on his shoulders, and then dropped him flat on his face. And he said the next time he sees Styles, it'll be in a match. Which is what's happening tomorrow night. This is a welcome development. Getting AJ Styles back in the singles ranks is something that can only improve the show. And I'm hoping the reason that this feels so rushed is because they want to get this over with as quickly as possible so they can move them on to other things. But it also means we're not going to get Styles against Omos at WrestleMania, which is great, because it opens up the possibility of a program with Edge and AJ Styles. Although if AJ does go babyface, I don't think they do that match. Then maybe we get Edge against Kevin Owens. I don't think Owens is winning the title at day one, but he should still have a marquee match at WrestleMania, and that's the one that I would do if they're not doing Edge and AJ. But anyway, this has me thinking that it may tie together in a roundabout way with the Lashley and MVP stuff. And here's how. If they're rushing to finish things off with AJ and Omos now, that means they must want to set something up, you know, for Omos, something big for him at WrestleMania. And if Bobby Lashley breaks away from MVP, I think we could be looking at a Lashley-Omos match for WrestleMania 38, with MVP taking on Omos as his newest client. The last time we saw Lashley and Omos in the ring together was a tag team match back in September. And I remember it because the people popped the first time they went face to face, because it's two giant men who have never faced off before. And I wonder if that wasn't a little test to see how the audience would react. MVP is a great on-screen character. If they break Lashley off on his own, MVP needs somebody new to manage. Omos cannot cut promos. He is terrible. He needs somebody to do the talking for him. Yeah, I wasn't even sure about Brock Lesnar, but we've seen more of his personality come out as a babyface in recent weeks without Paul Heyman, that if they put him and Heyman back together, I'm almost going to be sad. Because I've enjoyed seeing this other side of Brock on his own, talking for himself. Omos, I don't think, has it in him. Not yet. He can't be on his own cutting promos. I mean, he shouldn't be cutting long promos anyway, but this is WWE. Everybody's got to cut promos. He shouldn't be doing it on his own. He is terrible. He is no good at it. He needs somebody to do the talking for him. His job should not be to go out there and say much. Just stand there and look intimidating. And then throw people around when the bell rings. That's where MVP comes in. So I'm looking ahead, and that's what I'm seeing. That's the picture that's coming into focus for me. They build this week as the final chapter between Bianca Belair and Doudrop. They had two good matches on TV back-to-back weeks, and their third was also good, but it was all about the finish. A great fucking finish with Belair cutting off Doudrop, who was on the middle rope. She was setting up for a Vader bomb. And then powering this woman up on her shoulders to deliver the KOD for the win. Bianca had to work for that. You could see the people in the audience rising to their feet. They treated this like Brock Lesnar getting Big Show on his shoulders for his first F5 at Survivor Series in 2002. The arena popped huge for this. This was a really smart series of matches to book for Bianca. Doudrop looked good too, but this was all about getting over Bianca's power. And it worked like a charm, and I feel even stronger now than I did last week that the match at WrestleMania is Bianca Belair getting her title back from Becky Lynch. Finn Balor got a win over Austin Theory, who continues to look good in these matches against Big E and against Balor. The kid looks like he belongs. He hit this great-looking springboard Spanish fly out of nowhere that I wasn't expecting him to be able to do. In the end, it didn't matter. He lost. And the story is that he let down Vince McMahon. He couldn't even bring himself to walk into Vince's office after the match. He came up to the door and he couldn't knock on the door. Instead, he went and found Balor doing an interview in the back and he attacked him. Then he went to Vince's office and he said, "Look what I did. I beat up Balor." He's trying to impress Vince. And Vince mumbled his way through another segment. That's Vince McMahon these days. I did, however, in the mumbling, hear him talk about how he enjoyed firing people, especially around the holidays. It gives him a warm feeling, like after eating a good meal. Because he's a heel, you see. And it's funny to play off the fact that he has fired more wrestlers in 2021 than he has in any other single year in the history of this company. Hilarious. If you ever wanted to know what a melted candle looks like if you dressed it up in a suit and tie, just watch one of these Vince McMahon segments. Damian Priest was counted out in a championship contenders match against Dolph Ziggler when Big Bob tripped him up. Priest snapped, he attacked him outside, then got counted out. Nothing about anything we saw in this match made me even remotely interested in seeing the rematch. Rhea Ripley got her win back over Queen Zelina, and the story is that maybe she is better off without Nikki Ash. That's the story. Took them this long to figure out something I've been saying for months. Not only did we get a Miz TV segment on this show, we got a Cutting Edge segment with Edge interviewing Maryse. She was upset that Edge nearly speared her last week and asked him if he would do the same thing like he did to her, almost did to her, if he would do that to Beth Phoenix. Angle alert! Angle alert! Edge wasn't buying her bullshit and her being upset with The Miz, you know, after she slapped him last week. He figured this was all part of their plan to lull him into a false sense of security so he would let his guard down and then Miz would show up and attack him. So for once, I thought we had the opposite of dumb babyface syndrome. We have a babyface that actually is using his brain for a change. Edge was openly questioning this woman's motives. He was waiting for Miz, inviting Miz to come on out and show up. Miz's music hit. He tried attacking from behind. It was the plan. But Edge saw him coming. Maryse got involved. That allowed Miz to give Edge a skull-crushing finale. Again, while Miz and Maryse celebrated their plan working. So in the end, even though he saw their plan coming a mile away, he still got laid out anyway. So now they have to bring in Beth Phoenix to play the foil to Maryse. They've announced that Miz and Maryse are going to be renewing their wedding vows on Raw tomorrow night. So that would seem like the perfect place for it to happen. Before the show on Monday, WWE posted a video to its social media of Liv Morgan tracking down Becky Lynch at what Liv claimed was the gym that Becky and Seth Rollins own in Iowa. I guess she was talking... I thought maybe she was talking about Seth's Black and Brave Wrestling Academy. Maybe it wasn't. Maybe it was some other gym. The camera angles they used for this made it look really hokey. Liv attacks somebody who she thought was Becky from behind with a kendo stick. It turned out to be not Becky Lynch. It was one of her students who kind of sort of looked like her and had the red hair. And then the camera, you see the camera slowly pans back and we see Becky standing behind Liv. Liv ended up putting a whooping on her with the kendo stick. And then on Raw, said that it was disgusting how Becky would sacrifice one of her own students like that. Becky came out, Liv dared her to get into the ring, and Becky said, not as long as you've got that kendo stick in your hand. And Liv said, well, the kendo stick isn't for me, it's for you. And she threw it outside at Becky's feet, dared her to come in. Becky told her she was lucky she had a private jet to catch, and she left. You watch these segments every week, and everything leads you to think, how could Liv Morgan not win that title at day one? Right? I mean, that's the logical conclusion that you would come to. I wouldn't do it. Not now. You keep that title on Becky until WrestleMania. With Bianca. That's the right story to tell. The show ended with the tag team match that I mentioned with Lashley and Big E beating Rollins and Owens, and Lashley getting curb stomped on the ring steps. Rollins and Owens then embraced in the ring in a very comedic way. With Owens sticking around, I wouldn't be opposed to a longer-term alliance with him and Rollins after day one. It might actually help make Rollins more of an interesting character to me, which he is not right now. They've already announced several matches for the final Raw of the year tomorrow night in Detroit. Two rematches with Austin Theory against Finn Balor, and Damian Priest against Dolph Ziggler, this time for the U.S. title. AJ Styles takes on Omos, Randy Orton takes on Otis, Miz and Maryse renew their vows, and Veer Mahan will no doubt still be coming. Let's flip over to SmackDown. SmackDown on Friday was the holiday show taped a week earlier. Charlotte and Toni Storm had a decent match that I don't think elevated Toni Storm in any measurable way. Sami Zayn won a 12-man gauntlet match that had its moments to set Zayn up for an Intercontinental title match. And the babyfaces beat the heels in their annual Miracle on 34th Street fight, which was basically a house show main event to send the crowd home happy. It's kind of like when they do those tribute to the troop shows and all the babyfaces go over. That's basically what this was. But the best part of the show, as per usual, was Paul Heyman. Roman Reigns and Brock Lesnar were not even on the show. And these three were still the highlight of the entire thing. Heyman sat for a sit-down interview with Kayla Braxton. He was very somber. He hadn't shaved all week. He looked like he had probably an answering machine full of messages from angry ECW talent wanting to know where their money is. So he was very downtrodden, and he said, you know, he told the truth to Roman Reigns when he told him that he wasn't protecting Brock Lesnar from Roman. He was protecting Roman from Brock Lesnar. And he got fired for it. And he says he got publicly humiliated in front of the fans, in front of his colleagues. He says he doesn't regret it. His job as special counsel was to tell the truth. And Kayla asked him, well, what's next? And he said he didn't know. He took a sip of water and said, I don't know. He says, I could go to NXT and find the next top star down there, but at this stage, it's too late for that. He said, at this point in my life, it might just be that my career is over. Heyman was excellent here. And then later in the show, they aired a great video retrospective of Heyman's career. It looked like it was partially lifted from his DVD. Showing his days with the Dangerous Alliance in WCW with Steve Austin and Rick Rude. His days as the Mad Genius of ECW. They showed the night ECW invaded Raw in 2001, which was such a great angle. It's one of the greatest angles they've... One of the greatest segments in Raw history from that July 9th. I still remember the date. July 9th, 2001 episode of Raw. And then an hour later, Stephanie McMahon came out as the owner of ECW. They showed the Alliance losing its Survivor Series and said Heyman was then banished after that, only to reemerge alongside Brock Lesnar when Lesnar made his debut in 2002. And they showed highlights of Lesnar in the early days, beating Hulk Hogan and beating The Rock. And then they cut to him managing Lesnar in more recent years and Lesnar's loss to Drew McIntyre at last year's WrestleMania and how it looked like Heyman's career was done for. Until Roman Reigns reached down and pulled him back up. And he became the special counsel to the tribal chief. Reigns rescued him. And then last week, he fired him. And again, they tease that Heyman's career may be over. This is all tailor-made for a good old-fashioned swerve at day one with Heyman helping Reigns retain his Universal title. Now, maybe it's part of an elaborate scheme, or maybe Heyman just helps him to try to get back into his good graces. And there is no plan. And Reigns still says you're fired. They could play it like that, too. I think it's part of an elaborate scheme. It's like I said last week, they have too many Bloodline t-shirts left to sell that have Heyman's likeness on them. But this storyline has been the best part of WWE television, and it's not even close. And that goes for Raw, that goes for SmackDown, that goes for NXT. Anything they have done, anything they have produced for the last several months, these characters and this storyline has been the consistently best part of WWE television. Charlotte took most of the offense in her title defense against Toni Storm. She did her terrible double moonsault, where she landed on her feet. Toni rolled out of the way. Then Charlotte hits the standing moonsault, only it completely missed. This was a taped show. They had a week to edit this. And it was so bad, outside of just outright cutting it, there was nothing they could do. They felt there's nothing we could do to make this look any better. There's nothing we could do to save this. So we're just going to leave it in as is. If you keep doing the same move over and over and over again, and every single time you do it, it looks worse than the last, just don't do it. I don't know why she insists on continuing to use this move. I know that she loves Andrade. I know she loves Andrade. She posted a nice Christmas photo together. I know that she loves her boy toy over there. I'm just trying to figure out why she thinks it looks good. Charlotte is very good without it. And she's not a dumb person. I don't know how she can objectively watch her matches back and think, hey, that looked great. I think I'll do it again next week. She went for the pin after that. Toni Storm had to sell that. Flair tried to roll her up and pin her later on using the ropes for leverage, but she got caught. They traded cradles back and forth until Charlotte won the match with one. This was a decisive victory for Charlotte Flair. And Toni Storm, when the match was over, sat there and cried and cried and cried. Better luck next time. Except there won't be a next time at day one, because why would she get another match? She lost. What I'm hoping for is that we forget this ever happened and we move on to pairing her off with Sasha Banks for the start of an eventual program between the two of them. Sasha and Toni have been paired off on some of the house shows of late against Carmella and Zelina Vega, the current holders of the women's tag team paperweights. The way Sasha Banks talked up Toni backstage on TV a few weeks ago when she was giving her that big pep talk in the back, singing her praises. We know she has great respect and admiration for this woman. I'd like to see them win the tag team titles. Now, they wouldn't have anybody to defend them against, which is kind of a problem. Maybe they can float, but That almost doesn't even matter. The titles would be the device they could eventually use to split them up, give us a program between Toni Storm and Sasha Banks. I'm actually torn on this idea because right now at this moment, I know it's still a little early, but I'm leaning towards Sasha Banks winning the Royal Rumble and challenging Charlotte for the championship at WrestleMania. You know, been there, done that, I know, but that to me, I mean, Sasha Banks should be in that mix. She's never won the Royal Rumble before. Becky's won the Rumble. Charlotte's won the Rumble. This year, they had somebody new win the Rumble, which was nice to see. In fact, that came down to Bianca and Rhea. I love the finish of that Women's Royal Rumble match this year. It could have gone either way. You couldn't predict. Actually, it came down to, I think, the two of them and Charlotte. But then it came down to the two new faces, and you really couldn't predict. It could have literally gone either way. So this year, they gave us someone new, who then went on to WrestleMania and won the championship, and that was great. In 2022, I'm leaning towards a Sasha Banks win in the Royal Rumble match, because I think that's where she should be. But then in trying to think of, well, then what's next with Toni Storm, instead of her just disappearing from television again, you know, I really would like to see her and Sasha working together, so I'm kind of torn on which direction they should go in. We had a 12 Days of Christmas 12-man gauntlet match to determine who would challenge Shinsuke Nakamura for the Intercontinental title. I presume at day one, but that has not been made official yet. You know, a gauntlet is a good way to kill time. Most of this was filler. The real MVPs were Sheamus and Ricochet. Angel Garza survived his first two opponents, Mansoor, who you'll notice, Mansoor doesn't do shit. Unless they're in Saudi Arabia. Then he wins. All of a sudden, Mansoor gets a little push. I mean, I don't think they could be any more transparent about that if they tried. Garza fell to Shanky. Shanky then fell to Ivar. Sheamus beat Ivar, then Drew Gulak in 6 seconds. Then Cesaro, which never really had a chance to get going with Cesaro selling the injured ribs. They went 3 minutes before Ridge Holland distracted Cesaro, and that cost him the match. And then things really picked up with Sheamus and Ricochet. We got another distraction, this time from Cesaro, who came back out. And Ricochet rolled up Sheamus in 8 minutes to advance. Ricochet beat Humberto and Jinder Mahal in very quick matches. And then it came down to Ricochet and Sami Zayn. And Ricochet went for a shooting star press. Zayn got the knees up, exploder in the corner, followed by the Huluva kick. And Sami Zayn wins the gauntlet match. He will challenge Shinsuke Nakamura in a match that will probably not be nearly as good as their takeover match in Dallas 5 years ago, but it should still be very good. And Drew McIntyre, Kofi Kingston, and King Woods toppled the Usos and Madcap Moss in the Miracle on 34th Street fight. That is the third straight loss on TV for the SmackDown Tag Team Champs. Moss and Happy Corbin at ringside, they got eggnog dumped on their heads. We got all the Christmas silliness here in this match. McIntyre finished off Moss with a Claymore kick to win, which is a hell of a lead into their pay-per-view match. Old Madcap was actually part of the best moment right at the very end of the show when the copyright box came on and Michael Cole was signing off. Moss was standing outside the ring. All the babyfaces were just throwing gifts out to the audience. And Moss is standing there. He's kind of loopy from the Claymore kick. And he's right in front of the announce desk, but kind of looking, you know, into the audience. He has his back turned. And Kofi Kingston throws this giant gift box at his head. I mean, if he was playing darts in a bar, he would have hit the fucking bullseye. And this box hit Madcap in the back of the head. It smacked him in the back of the head. He sold it like a bullet had gone through his skull. And he slowly fell face down on the ground. That was great. That's the best thing he's done his entire career. But the day one pay-per-view is this Saturday from Atlanta. We have the go-home show tomorrow night since there is no new SmackDown show on Friday. They're just doing a highlight show on FS1. So I'll run through my predictions now. I don't really expect there to be much on the show tomorrow night, that's going to change my mind about any of these. Randy Orton and Matt Riddle were to have defended their Raw Tag Team titles against the winner of the RK Bronament between Rey and Dominic Mysterio and the Street Profits. But I guess the Street Profits, or Montez Ford in particular, is indisposed at the moment for whatever reason, so the match may be off. If they do defend their titles, though, it doesn't even matter who it's against. RK-Bro's not losing, so they're my pick to win. If Sami Zayn gets his Intercontinental title match at Day One against Nakamura, I have Sami winning the championship. There's more that you could do with him as the champion than Nakamura right now. I was thinking of Sheamus, Nakamura, maybe doing a program with them for WrestleMania. But could just as easily see Sami Zayn defending in a multi-man match, like a ladder match at WrestleMania, that Sheamus would probably be involved in anyway. So I have Sami winning the title. The Usos have been three-time losers on TV in recent weeks. Roman Reigns should be firing them, too, after Paul Heyman. They lose so much. They cannot lose again. They have to win here. I have them retaining their titles over the New Day, the SmackDown Tag Team titles. Drew McIntyre goes one-on-one with Madcap Moss. And I know it sounds insane. I am picking Madcap for the win. A McIntyre win seems almost too obvious to me. And with him pinning Moss at the end of that street fight on Friday and Happy Corbin lurking around, you know, if they're going to set up a match, which I know they are, between Corbin and McIntyre coming up next, one way to really anger McIntyre would be to have Corbin cost him the win. Maybe he gets disqualified, maybe he gets counted out and doesn't get, you know, pinned or rolled up or anything like that. But I just have this sneaking feeling that Moss is going to get the win. So I'm going to go with Madcap. Edge takes on The Miz. Miz and Maryse are renewing their vows on Raw tomorrow night. We'll see if that sets up a Beth Phoenix appearance. And if Day One turns into a mixed tag team match. I think they're going to do the singles match as planned, but set up a mixed tag to follow that. You know, I can't see this living up to the quality of any of the three matches that Edge had with Seth Rollins. Not any of them. The question is, do they drag this out to WrestleMania and do the mixed tag match there? Is that why Maryse is back on TV, to build to WrestleMania? You know, or is Edge going to have a big singles match against someone else on that show? If it's the former, then Miz could win here. He could win this match. If not, then Edge should win to build to something, you know, bigger at WrestleMania. I'm going to go with an Edge win. I think he's taken the W here. I mean, how could they possibly keep this interesting until WrestleMania when they're already running on fumes with dueling talk show segments every week? How many more cutting edges in Miz TVs can we get between now and April? You think they're going to drag it out? You think they have enough creative wits about them to drag this fucking thing out for another 3 months? Becky Lynch defends her Raw Women's Championship against Liv Morgan. Liv Morgan lost on TV to Becky few weeks ago, just like Toni Storm lost to Charlotte on Friday. There was never any chance that Becky was losing that title on Raw. This time, they're on pay-per-view. It's the rematch. The stars seemed aligned for a Liv Morgan win here to shock the world. She needs this win. I know a lot of people are rooting for her, but I am predicting another Becky Lynch win, with this being the nail in the coffin of the current Liv Morgan push. Becky Lynch has been champion every day since WrestleMania 35. Every day that she has been on the active roster, so her maternity leave aside, this woman has been a champion. WrestleMania 38 is going to mark 3 years that streak began. Liv Morgan should not be the person to interrupt that. I'm sorry. It should be Bianca Belair at WrestleMania. That is the story to tell. And Day One is not a big enough stage for that. I know all the Liv fans are not going to want to hear that, but it's the way it needs to be. Morgan has shown a lot with this push that she's gotten in the ring, on the mic. You know, she's gotten more mic time than she has her entire career. I don't think we're getting two Riot Squad members holding gold in January. Just one. And that one is the TBS title in AEW. Not the Raw Women's title. Becky Lynch retains. Big E defends the WWE Championship at a Fatal 4-Way against Seth Rollins, Kevin Owens, and Bobby Lashley. I think Owens takes the losing fall. I think Big E is going to retain. I wouldn't have said that a few weeks ago. I was thinking Seth Rollins would pull out the win. back when it was still a triple threat. Then they added Lashley, who might be going face, and now I'm looking at this and I'm thinking Big E is going to retain. And Seth Rollins is going to have the built-in excuse that he didn't get pinned. And it should never have been a four-way to begin with. He had a contract for a championship match with Big E before anybody else did. And then at the Royal Rumble, we get a proper singles match for the title between Rollins and Big E. I still feel like Big E is not going to have that belt, though, going into WrestleMania. I still feel that way, but I don't think he loses it at day one. And Roman Reigns defends the Universal title against Brock Lesnar. If Paul Heyman was right when he said that he was protecting Roman from Brock, it stands to reason that without Heyman, Reigns is vulnerable and could finally lose his championship. This is going to be the first title defense for Roman Reigns without Paul Heyman by his side. So if this is not a giant swerve, I can't say that it wouldn't be cool to see Lesnar win the title and then reunite with Paul Heyman at the end of the night. You know, the two of them go together like peanut butter and jelly. But I think it's all a swerve. And with Heyman's help, Roman Reigns is going to retain the Universal title. And Brock Lesnar will go on a fucking rampage heading into the Royal Rumble. He won't go on rampage. He'll go on a rampage heading into the Rumble. I think it is increasingly likely we end up getting a triple threat match at WrestleMania with Roman Reigns, Brock Lesnar, and Drew McIntyre thrown in. Because outside of yet another singles match that they could do with Reigns and Lesnar at Mania, I mean, McIntyre is the only other possible name I could see wrestling Roman Reigns. But Roman first has to hold on to his title to get there, and I think he will. As long as he's been champion for, if his reign is coming to an end, WrestleMania at Texas Stadium feels like it would be the better place for it to happen. So what do I have here? I am predicting one title changes hands on the entire show, and that's for a match that hasn't even been made official yet. So I may be going against the odds, but I'm going to stick to my guns on that. If anything happens on Raw tomorrow night to change my mind, I'm sure I'll tweet about it. Be sure to hit the YouTube channel as soon as day one is over. I will be live with the recap next Saturday night. And that will lead right into episode 737 next Sunday. You get a double podcast the first weekend of the new year. Actually, you get a triple because I'm going live on New Year's Eve. I'm streaming from 1 year into the next, baby. This train don't slow down. NXT 2.0. Let's talk about NXT here for a little bit. There was an item in this week's Observer about that horrible Lash Legend match that I talked about last week from 205 Live against Saray. It was only her second match. Her first one with Amari Miller was okay. But I watched the second one and it was atrocious. I would be embarrassed to put that out on television. Well, it turns out what we saw was the edited version. If that was the edited version, how bad did the original look? Meltzer said from internal sources it was one of the most edited matches before it aired, and it was described that they cut it down to 3 minutes of highlights. I put that in quotes. And even in that form, it was still one of the worst WWE television matches of the year. You don't say. This is what happens when you put people on TV who have no business being on TV. She's a rookie. She played basketball before this. She is not a wrestler yet. She is learning to be a wrestler. She is training to be a wrestler. You don't put people like that on TV unless they have an aptitude for it. And a very rare few people will have an aptitude that quickly for professional wrestling to where a few matches in, they just pick it up that quickly, you know, like Kurt Angle or somebody. She ain't no Kurt Angle. You don't put those people in a position to look bad. Unless you're WWE. Not that anybody actually watches 205 Live. I guess that's the one saving grace. Although now, this became such a big story that the match has been shared on YouTube and it probably got more views because of it. But it won't be long. You know it won't be long before they put her in a ring on Tuesdays. And even if it is the developmental show, I don't see how that's going to do her any favors. This early. I don't see how that does her any favors. We got not one, but two superstars from Raw making cameos on this week's NXT. Matt Riddle in another pre-tape with MSK. He'll be there live with them to, I guess, COVID permitting. I don't know what's up with Matt. He was conspicuous by his absence from Raw on Monday night, so we'll have to see. He is being advertised, though, for a live appearance with MSK to confront Imperium this Tuesday. And AJ Styles, who bypassed NXT and went straight to the main roster 6 years ago, made his NXT debut in the ring to confront Grayson Waller, who was talking shit about him and his haircut on social media. Them are fighting words. You talk about somebody's haircut, they're going to come and hunt you down. The ratings have cratered for NXT in recent weeks, under 600,000. So now they're bringing in Raw talent to try to boost interest in the show and pour it over some of those Raw viewers, what's left of those viewers. Styles said Waller was calling him out for clout, calling him out to get some rub. He even pointed out that Waller wears gloves the same way that AJ wears gloves. Waller teased fighting him, but then he left the ring. He said, Omos can have you first, I got next. I assume this is setting up a match at New Year's Evil between the two, which is the first NXT episode of the new year. Actually, I might go live after that too. Almost forgot about New Year's Evil. That's going to be a busy week, that first week of the year. Got Wrestle Kingdom is coming up next week. Anyway, I assume this is leading to a match at New Year's Evil between the two. You don't bring AJ Styles to NXT and tease a match and then don't do a match. And since there's no takeovers announced, or whatever they're calling them now, that January 4th, is it January 4th? Whatever that Tuesday is, that would seem the most likely place to make it happen. They're going in hard on trying to get Waller over as a heel. You know, he also attacked Dexter Lumis from behind with a chair after his win over Trick Williams. Waller is just pissing everybody off. But if anybody can give him a memorable match and help make him look like he belongs, AJ Styles would be that guy. With Riddle being the shaman for MSK, they interviewed Imperium, who said, MSK may have a shaman, but we have a general. And that got my attention, because it is the first tease that we've gotten for a Walter appearance since the NXT relaunch and since he lost his UK title to Ilya Dragunov. I don't think Walter fits on this show at all, but it sounds like Riddle may be the corner man for MSK in their tag team title match. And maybe Walter then corners Imperium, and or they're building to a six-man tag soon, with Riddle and MSK teaming up against Walter and Imperium. Which would be great, great TV. Imperium and MSK are two fantastic teams. But you throw in Riddle and Walter, or Riddle against Walter, and that's a match that I would love to see. That could be a main roster match. In a perfect world, that would be a main roster match. Of course, what they do with Walter on the main roster, that remains to be seen. There was a good promo segment with Tommaso Ciampa and Bron Breakker to help build their title match at New Year's Evil. Ciampa, I thought, was really good here. He pointed out Breakker slipping on the ropes in their last match at Halloween Havoc and how that one mistake could cost him. So I like that. I like the botch being incorporated into this idea that he's the rookie and all it takes is one mistake and it's lights out. Raquel Gonzalez and Dakota Kai had a street fight that actually started out like one in the back as Gonzalez was getting ready to head out to the ring. They eventually fought out to the ring. I thought the picture-in-picture break here hurt. It only went about 5 minutes, so you know, sticking the break in there killed it a little bit. But once they came back, they used weapons, kendo sticks, tables, chairs, trash cans. It was like War Games all over again. I feel like we've seen a lot of garbage matches with the women in recent months, more than we ever have before. It's like they're trying to get them conditioned for it. So they can be very hit or miss. This was one of the better ones. Gonzalez picked up the win, hitting her Chicona bomb on Kai onto a trash can. That should wrap up this feud. This felt like a blow-off to me. Gonzalez called out Mandy Rose after she got Cora Jade instead. Darby Allin has left the chat. She said she wants to make Toxic Attraction pay for injuring her arm. And Mandy interrupted with a video promo. She was poolside in a very skimpy bikini. She has gigantic breasts, which is what they were trying to convey here. They made that very clear. It's one of those new directions with the new NXT, whereas, you know, before the focus was on who the best wrestler is. Now with Toxic Attraction, it's the Attitude Era sex appeal stuff, which worked great back in the day, right? Sable had all the enhancements that she had, and she was out there half naked every week, and she was one of the biggest stars in the business. You know, Roman Reigns now talks about needle movers. CM Punk is not a needle mover. I move the needle. He's got a new t-shirt that says needle mover. The reality is there is no such thing these days as a needle mover. Sable was more of a needle mover, legitimately, 25 years ago or 23 years ago than anybody else in the entire wrestling business right now. And that's not an exaggeration. The woman made that company a lot of money. Her segments would, you would see in the quarter hour numbers, her segments, they would shoot up. She was a needle mover. She moved a lot of needles in more ways than one. But anyway, it hasn't been working the same way with NXT. They're trying to appeal to a younger demo, but their audience has somehow gotten even older. Their median viewer age this week, according to WrestleNomics, was 64. This is supposed to be the youthful, hip show that the, you know, for the younger crowd. 64 years old. If they get any older, they're going to need those life alert things to wear around their neck. But all the old dudes, they love Mandy's big voluptuous breasts, apparently. She offered to defend her title against both women at the same time at New Year's Evil in a triple threat match, which is very strange, a strange idea to float when you're the champion. And you could lose your title without being pinned. And she's a heel. JC Jane and Gigi Dolan blindsided Gonzalez and Jade in the ring with kendo sticks. They set up a table in the corner, sent Raquel crashing through it, which left her buried under the rubble. This Tuesday, Jade and Gonzalez will wrestle Dolan and Jane in a non-title match. Can they coexist? We're going to find out. Speaking of Mandy Rose and her voluptuous breasts, we follow that up with some jacket time. Kushida and Ikem and Jiro. They brought out their own little mock announcer's desk to sit at for a match between the Creed brothers and the grizzled young veterans who have gone from a serious tag team that I could not give a shit about to being booked like a less funny Abbott and Costello that I still cannot give a shit about. This went to a no contest when both teams ended up outside. They were teasing putting someone through Jacket Time's desk. They got up in the face of the Creed brothers. GYV shoved the Creed brothers into Kushida and Jiro and a brawl broke out. Briggs and Jensen, the wannabe APA guys, they also showed up. They got involved. The Creed brothers, I can honestly say, are literally the only ones I care about of these four teams. They are the only ones. Joe Gacy said Harlan wanted to apologize for what he did to Brian Kendrick the week before, throwing him down a flight of stairs. But Kendrick, he offended Harlan by calling him a freak. So he isn't blameless in this. He victim-shamed Brian Kendrick. Kendrick, meanwhile, showed up in a cell phone promo later in the night wearing a neck brace before he ripped it off and said that he officially resigned his position as a coach and signed a waiver so that he could show up next week to get an apology from Harlan directly. I'm sure that will go well for him. He should try to get Harlan up for one of those burning hammers like he did Dakota Ibushi in the Cruiserweight Classic. I still remember Bryan Danielson marking out on commentary for that. I mentioned that Dexter Lumis got a win over Trick Williams. During that match, the Cruiserweight champion Roderick Strong came out. He brawled with Carmelo Hayes, the North American champion, brawled all the way to the back, which left Williams out there to fend for himself. Last week, I said that they should just unify the two titles and get rid of the Cruiserweight belt altogether, because it is useless. I've never seen so many paperweights for titles at one time in this company. The Intercontinental title has been a paperweight now for the last few months. The women's tag team titles on the main roster are two giant paperweights. And the Cruiserweight title is a smaller paperweight. It's under 205 pounds. Just get rid of it. That's what I said. Just get rid of it. There's no need for it. Well, guess what they announced this week? A title unification for New Year's Evil between Carmelo Hayes and Roderick Strong. Wade Barrett will host the contract signing for it this Tuesday. One less paperweight. Maybe Melo can melt it down into a chain to wear around his neck. like Kama did with the Undertaker's urn. Idris Inoue picked up a shock win over Von Geek, who was out there being scouted by Robert Stone, which is the kiss of death. I've already run down the long list of victims that have fallen Final Destination style after being associated with the Robert Stone brand. Wagner was in control. He fell to a sunset bomb and was pinned. He attacked Inoue after the match and left him laying. So this wasn't about Inoue winning so much as it was whatever story they're telling with Wagner. He needs guidance. I guess Robert Stone is going to provide him that guidance. Shout out to Inoue out there looking more polished in the ring than a lot of other people on this show. Trained by B-Boy out of San Diego, the same B-Boy who helped train Dominic Mysterio. Although Dominic has been trained by a lot of people. He's been trained with Jay Lethal, training with Lance Storm. A little bit of this, a little bit of that. Always good to get experience from different places. And Tony D'Angelo had the best match of his life against Pete Dunne in the main event. Dunne carried this thing along, but D'Angelo more than held his own. He looks good in there for someone with so few matches under his belt. After the match, D'Angelo attacked Dunne, gave him the twisting fisherman buster on the floor, and then took a crowbar to Dunne's hand, the one that he uses for all of his joint manipulation spots. He sold it like his hand was broken, and they put the heat right back on D'Angelo as they went off the air. Very similar to what they did with Grayson Waller a few weeks ago, where he laid out Johnny Gargano at the end of the show. They're trying to put heat on some of the new guys by having them lay out the veterans. I thought there was more good than bad on this show, but it's very obvious what is going on with these Raw cameos. We'll see if it works. Let's take some mailbag questions. If you have any questions to send in, you may do so. TheSoloMonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in, like Kevin from Albany. I'm a big fan of Pat McAfee. I've been following his show since 2015, so I liked him well before his NXT appearances. I know ratings won't show it, but I actually only signed up for WWE Network for a month to see his match with Adam Cole. But after the great news of his big deal with FanDuel, how much longer do you see him with WWE? I don't think the money and time commitment will take him away, but WWE signed a partnership with DraftKings last year, which is a competitor to FanDuel, who is giving McAfee $120 million. So it might be a conflict of interest. Yes, they can have Michael Cole read the ads, but still, if they are paying someone all that money, they may not want him part of a show that's going to push a competitor. What do you think? I don't think it'll be an issue. And if it was, they would have broached it with him beforehand. Look, a deal that big, both sides are doing their due diligence before signing the paperwork, believe me. You know, McAfee's going to be making more money in the first year of this sponsorship deal than he made his entire NFL career. He made $15 million playing in the NFL over 8 seasons. He's going to make 8 times that amount each year for 4 years. And that's without taking any bumps on the field. I think he'll be fine. He does the WWE gig because he enjoys it. He said before, he gets paid peanuts by WWE compared to what he was already making, let alone what he's going to be making now. As long as he doesn't go on TV and personally endorse DraftKings, then I don't see it being a problem. Chris from Northern New Jersey, do you think Liv Morgan's push is to counter AEW rightfully pushing Ruby Soho? Just like I feel Queen Zelina's push is a counter to Malakai Black killing it in AEW. Also, I'm concerned about AEW bloating their roster and a lot of favorites, homegrown and otherwise, getting lost in the fold. We'd love to hear your thoughts. I don't think the Liv Morgan push has anything to do with Ruby Soho. I mean, you know, you could look at it and I could see WWE, you know, doing petty stuff. I don't even know if petty is the right word for it. I'm glad to see both women getting a push. It shouldn't have taken this long to see them featured. But no, I don't think one has to do with the other. As far as your other concern about AEW bloating its roster, yes, it's a concern. Absolutely. They are bringing in more and more people. They don't really get rid of anybody, which at some point they're going to. But they're not getting rid of people. They're bringing in new ones. And, you know, some people are just slotted right where they belong. You know, they'll kind of fill a role on the show. But there are going to be people who get brought in who are hoping to do bigger and better things than maybe what they were doing in WWE, let's say if that's where they came from, who are, I think, could become very disillusioned very quickly when they realize that there's a lot of competition in that company. And they may not be doing some of the things that they would have hoped to be doing. So I think in 2022, you're going to start to hear some more stories, I think, about some unrest behind the scenes. It doesn't mean that they're going to start quitting and leaving and going, you know, to WWE or other places. But I do think, I mean, how could it not be? You're going to have people on that show who want to spread their wings and do their thing, and they may find that they may not be able to do so. You know, there is a point that you reach, we may have already reached it, where the roster is just so big. And I don't think adding more shows is the answer, because then you just burn people out, where you're going to end up with some unhappy people. So is it a concern? Yeah. Yeah, it is. Rodimus Prime from Alexander City, Alabama. How would you rank these five Japanese wrestlers? Antonio Inoki, Kenta Kobashi, Kazuchika Okada, Shinya Hashimoto, and the Great Muda. You know, it's so hard to answer a question like this. I feel like if I don't say Kobashi or Misawa, who you left out, that, you know, the mob is going to come after me. I wish Liger was on that list too. There's just been so many great ones. For me personally, which is all I can answer for, Okada is the best. So Okada is going to be number one on my list. When it comes to Japanese wrestling, of the names that you just mentioned. Then I would put Kobashi, then I would put Muda, then Inoki, and I know just based on influence and historical significance, Inoki would be number one, but I'm not a fan of his work like I am the others. In the ring, I'm not as much of a fan of his work. A lot of it was also before my time, so he is number four, and then I would put Hashimoto on the bottom just because I'm not as familiar with his work either. But Okada would be my number one. Dylan from Kirksville, Missouri. I know this will never happen, but if Brock Lesnar was to ever sign with AEW, what would you think of him in addition to wrestling, mentoring guys like Hook and or Powerhouse Hobbs on television? I think they'd kick all kinds of ass together and be pretty damn entertaining. I don't see Brock as the mentoring type on TV. Behind the scenes, you know, offering advice, sure. He actually mentored Gable Steveson. You know, when he was still in school. I could see him being a mentor to Steveson when he makes it up to the main roster. Hey, he's already got a spot on Raw, apparently. Right? He was drafted. He was the last name drafted. Even though he's still training to become a wrestler, hasn't had a match yet, he's already drafted to Monday Night Raw. I don't see Brock being the mentoring type on TV, though. You know, behind the scenes is a different story. I think he would be used much the same way that WWE uses him. One of the only guys they've managed to not fuck up over all these years. Limited appearances. Maybe not as limited, but limited appearances. Keep him special. Have him work a mix of big names and a few younger ones. You know, imagine a Lesnar-Darby Allin match, right? I know some people are going to hear that. They're going to groan. But I was looking forward, you know, to Lesnar against Finn Balor when they announced it the first time and they had a good match. You know, some of Brock's best, most entertaining matches were against men who were smaller than him. Like a Balor, like an AJ Styles or a Daniel Bryan, a CM Punk. I think Lesnar and Darby would be a lot of fun. The problem is there's too many guys who fit that mold, size-wise. In AEW, to where I don't think the AEW roster would be a great fit for Brock Lesnar. I think he's better off staying right where he is, and he knows that. Doesn't mean that he wouldn't play the two sides against each other for a, you know, better deal and get more money. He did that with WWE and UFC. But Brock Lesnar in AEW is just pure fantasy. Doug in Ohio, King of Doug style. From our YouTube streams, I know it's a long shot, but if somehow WWE was able to get The Rock for WrestleMania against Roman Reigns, what would you think if Rock was a surprise entrant in the Royal Rumble and wins it to set up Rock against Reigns? I'm not a fan. Rock does not have to win the Royal Rumble to set up a match with Roman Reigns. We already got Edge coming back and winning the Rumble 11 years after his last win. You know, you come back the following year and you have The Rock, who's even older, win the match 22 years after his last win. I think that would be awful. It would be a cool surprise just to hear the music and see him come out. If they could actually keep it under wraps, people would lose their minds. But I just think it's completely unnecessary. Anna from Massachusetts. I was recently thinking of the angle between the NWO, Rock, and Hogan and thought, what if they had The Rock turn heel earlier than he did as Hollywood Rock and join the NWO? He was planned to go heel anyway, and he could have easily explained that it was a turn on the fans who had turned on him at WrestleMania 18. Now that's interesting. You replace Hollywood Hogan with Hollywood Rock in the NWO. Maybe even do a double turn at WrestleMania 18. It's kind of what we got anyway. The thing is, Rock didn't need the NWO. They would have been more than happy to leech off of him. I don't know that it would have made sense for him to hook up with those guys, but I agree. I wish we had gotten many more months of Hollywood Rock than we did. Hollywood Rock and Hollywood Batista. They both came far too late. And speaking of Hollywood, this is a good place to talk about this. I did mention at the beginning of the podcast that after 2 years, I finally this week sat down to watch the movie Joker with Joaquin Phoenix. Yeah, I've seen all the other Batman movies, and yeah, The Dark Knight is probably my all-time favorite movie. I love The Dark Knight. That is a movie I could sit down and watch anytime. Everyone, all the different characters in that movie. Obviously, the Joker, Heath Ledger in that movie was just fantastic. So I am very familiar with the Batman universe and the Joker character, and even like, you know, some of the graphic novels and the Killing Joke and Mark Hamill as the Joker and the animated series. Like, you know, I am a Joker guy, a Batman and Joker guy. So when I heard Joker was made, it is surprising it took me this long to sit down and watch this thing. I know the reaction to it was very polarizing, so I didn't really know what I was going to think after I watched it. And when it was over, I thought it took a while, to really get going. But that's what happens with origin stories, right? They take their time. I was kind of bored, though, through the first part of the movie. Those last few scenes at the end were fantastic. You know, on the talk show with De Niro, and then all the anarchy in the streets and Batman's parents being gunned down. I thought the ending was perfect. And I thought the way it was shot, I thought the music they used. There's a lot of great things about this movie. Even though it's based around a comic book character, when you are done watching it, you realize it's not really a comic book movie. I imagine some of the hate that the film got had to do with using the Joker as the main character. You know, they followed nothing from the comics. That was intentional on the part of the director and the writers. I knew that coming into it, so I was kind of prepared for it, but this could just as easily have been a story about a man named Arthur. You can call the movie Arthur. A man suffering from mental illness and, you know, child abuse, and you call it Arthur, and you don't piggyback off the Batman universe. But then it wouldn't have made nearly as much money as it did. And that's what this felt like. It's the story of a man neglected by society and by his own family, who becomes this raging psychopath. But let's set it in Gotham City, and we'll put the Wayne family in it to give it just that little bit of Batman influence. And we'll make a bunch of money off of it. It's like these Cloverfield sequels that aren't really sequels at all. They just slapped the Cloverfield name on it at the last minute because they wouldn't have made as much money without it. I enjoyed it, though. I don't think it's an all-time classic like some people say it is. It's not a movie I would go back and watch a second time. Once is enough, I think. Again, as opposed to a movie like Dark Knight. Just my personal preference. That's a movie I could watch 1,000 times. You know, one person tweeted me and said that he saw this in the theater 5 different times. Well, that was me with The Dark Knight when it came out. I saw it in the theater 3 times. Once in IMAX, which was fucking awesome because the theater I saw it in, the screen was just gigantic. Part of the screen came like overhead. So like when that movie opened and you had the scene on the zip line with, you know, before the bank robbery and everything, like it just visually like, oh my God. So yeah, I mean, I get it. Some people, when you're really into it, you can go and watch, you know, the movie a whole bunch of times. I thought Joaquin Phoenix was really good. You know, Heath Ledger is still the best Joker. All due respect to Mark Hamill. He's great too, but I'm talking movie Jokers. I thought they did a great job with the look and the feel of the movie. It felt like something out of the 80s. It really did. It felt like something out of the early to mid 80s. One thing I noticed about the movie is that they really kind of paid tribute to some older like 70s films. The thing that jumped out to me was the subway scene. That was something that was clearly lifted right out of the movie Death Wish with Charles Bronson. Only I think they did it better in Joker. And there's other little homages as well to kind of, I don't know, like the cinema that it kind of fits into is this, I guess you would say like these movies from the 70s that just felt hopeless. Crime-laden cities, you know, society falling apart. They captured that vibe. Clearly, I think they were going for... I mean, I guess that's Gotham City, though, right? But that's clearly the vibe they were going for. So I appreciate that. When the movie was over, I thought, man, that was a really good movie. I just didn't think it was this, oh my God, you know, I can't believe I didn't see this for so long. This is the greatest thing I've ever seen. I didn't come away from it feeling like that. And again, I wasn't really as into the early half of the movie. But as it barreled towards the end, it definitely got better. You know, when you have the revelation about what happened to him when he was a kid and you realize why he is the way that he is and has these outbursts. And then those last couple of scenes, which, you know, I won't spoil here, but although I'm sure by now you've all seen it, right? I feel like I'm the only fucking person who didn't see this movie. So I enjoyed Joker, but I would not put it in my all-time elite list of movies that I've seen. And even though it's not really a comic book movie, I know because it has a comic book villain in it, or it's based around a comic book villain, some people are going to look at it as a comic book movie. I don't look at it as a comic book movie. Again, I think it was just someone who liked the Joker and wanted to use the Joker character and the Joker name to attach to this, you know, other character, give it his own history, doesn't play off the comics really at all. But I think it was more of a cash grab than anything else. I just think, hey, you know, we'll call it Joker. You had to know people were going to go into it and have certain expectations, and there were going to be people who were disappointed in what they saw. I can understand it. I get it. I get why now there was the level of hate that there was. I still think the movie gets more love than hate, right? It's rated pretty high, I think, on IMDb and Rotten Tomatoes, and it deserves a lot of the praise that it gets. I just wouldn't go totally over the top with it. But I enjoyed it. I didn't feel like it was a waste of 2 hours of my life. I had one person tweet me and go, get ready to waste 2 hours of your life. I didn't feel like I wasted 2 hours of my life. But I also won't be going back to watch it again. It is a very depressing movie. It's a movie that's not going to put you in a very rosy mood. Unlike this podcast, where I try to put you guys in a happy mood every week. I want to thank you for all of the support you guys sent my way this week. It means a lot. This has been a tremendous year. Here's on to bigger and better in 2022. Here as we close out the final sound off of 2021. Again, there is a top 15 countdown coming of the greatest matches of the year. I will keep you guys posted on when and where, what form it will take, if I'll be live or not. I'm working to finalize that. I will be live after Dynamite, the final Dynamite of the year, back at Daly's Place on Wednesday, and then live again on Friday night. Not just talking Rampage, but it's New Year's Eve. So we're going to hang out on New Year's Eve. And then that night on Saturday is another live stream because it's day one. And we'll recap the pay-per-view, and I'll come back with you for episode 737, the first sound-off of next year, on Sunday, January 2nd. So, until then, Be well, stay safe, have yourselves a fantastic week. And if I don't see you with me on the streams this week, have a very happy new year. And I will see you guys next year. Until then, happy holidays.
The Solomonster sounds off.
The 24/7 nonsense on this show taught us this week that the single most dangerous maneuver isn't the RKO, it isn't the hurt lock, it isn't the curb stomp, it is the roll-up, because nobody is able to kick out of it. The only positive thing I can say about any of this is that at least it came during the lowest rated hour in Raw history. The less eyeballs on this shit, the better.
The Solomonster sounds off, each week bursting with content. Podcasts, predictions, reviews, YouTube live streams, and more. Become a channel member for perks and follow the Solomonster on Twitter at Solomonster.
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 Solomonster sounds off.